According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, one in three women and one in four men have been a victim of some form of physical violence from an intimate partner within their lifetime. In recognition of Domestic Violence Month, we will talk to survivors and advocates to get a better perspective on what goes on behind closed doors and what we can do to change that scenario. We're interested in your questions and comments during the program. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post to the website at weku.fm or the WEKU Facebook page. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. In just a few minutes, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, discussing domestic violence, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsberg, and this week on the program, domestic violence. October is observed every year as Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we're a little bit late to the table, but still wanting to focus on this very important topic in the midst of everything else going on in our world. This is one of the more serious circumstances that many families and that affects many relationships. And we're hoping that during today's program, we'll hear from you with any questions, any comments, or any personal stories that you may have. I want to welcome to our studio three guests. And these guests represent kind of three different aspects of the domestic violence situation in Central Kentucky. First up, Diane Fleet is Assistant Director at Greenhouse 17 in Lexington, serving 17 counties in Central Kentucky, providing shelter, counseling services, court advocacy, and a variety of other services. Diane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Lisa Murray, and Lisa is a survivor of domestic violence and works for Alltech Incorporated, and I understand your employer has been very instrumental in providing support to you through this circumstance, and you have taken advantage of the services provided by Greenhouse 17, and you're surviving, and you're right here strong and ready to tell us your story today. Thank you, Lisa.
Yes, thank you very much for having me here. I never thought I would ever see myself as a victim of anything, let alone domestic violence. But on the night of September 20th of 2011, the man that I was married to, my husband, brutally beat me. My head beaten into a wood floor, my face pummeled to a pulp, lost hearing in my right ear. That night, I fled for my life with my keys in my hand, was able to get into my car, and I got to a gas station where I fell out of my car, and individuals at a local store pulled me into their store, locked their doors, called the police, and I said that night started the darkest journey of my life.
Well, we want to hear more about that journey during this hour, Lisa. You are brave, and I'm very thrilled to be able for you to share your story with us today, and I want to talk a little bit, and we want to get to some of this terminology with Diane here in a bit, whether we describe people as victims, and what is the terminology we use around domestic violence. Again, we will come back to Lisa's story in just a few minutes, and Amy Schumacher has a story to tell as well. Of course, in January of 2015, her brother Todd was stabbed and killed by his partner in a domestic violence situation. And Amy, you're the only family member in the area, the family originally from Wisconsin.
Yes. I'm here to tell a story and hopefully get the message across that any form of domestic violence is not acceptable.
Whether it's between men and women or whether it's men as victims of domestic violence. And let me turn back. Let our listeners know that we do want to hear from you. We're going to hear some powerful stories today, and this is going to be a conversation that may be a little bit difficult to hear, but we also want to talk about hope, and we want to talk about moving forward whenever we discuss a topic of this type. We're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories. Feel free to write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Post on the Facebook page of the WEKU website. More importantly, feel free to call in and go ahead and pick up the phone and call 800-621-8890, 800-621-8890. And Diane, we want to get into these very powerful stories, but let's just define some terminology. Let's define domestic violence and talk a little bit about the numbers and how many people are affected by domestic violence.
Sure. So at Greenhouse 17, we really work with intimate partner violence. So there's lots of different categories of family violence, child abuse. We have a lot of focus now on elder abuse because we have an aging population, but our focus is intimate partner violence. And we define that by it's a pattern of abuse that a person uses to exert power and control over another individual. So we really try to get away from just that concept of physical violence, that usually perpetrators use multiple tactics to control another individual. Sometimes that includes physical, but it also has coercion, using economic or financial leverage over another person, isolation, shaming, using their religion. And there's a woman, she's since deceased, but her name is Ellen Pence, and she coined the power and control wheel. So if anybody ever wanted to Google the power and control wheel, you can look at it, and it sort of talks about different ways, very systematic ways that perpetrators use to control victims. And it looks different, too, depending on who you are. So you may see a power and control wheel that's very general, but immigrants face different categories of control. Men, as we were talking with Amy a little bit earlier, men have a special barrier of shame coming forward to say that they're a victim of domestic violence. People of higher socioeconomic status have difficulty coming forward. So there's lots of different ways that perpetrators use control over their victim.
And there's so many stereotypes, I guess, and we have so many images in our minds. And I mean, I know domestic violence has been something that our society has been aware of in a very public way ever since, was it the Farrah Fawcett movie, The Burning Bed,
right.
Going back
mm-hmm.
maybe 30 years or something like that. And people who fight back mm-hmm. As a result of domestic violence, sometimes they get labeled as criminals, sometimes they end up imprisoned because of their reaction to what has occurred. I mean, to what extent are the stereotypes? I guess I think in terms of stereotype, big, strong man with muscles and tattoos beating up on his little wife.
Right. I think so, absolutely. And so we really try to break that myth a little bit, you know. And again, I think that's why we try to get away from just the physical violence, because there's so many different ways that a person can use to be controlling over their partner. So in Kentucky, we've noticed, or not noticed, but about 1 in 3 women at some point in their lifetime will experience domestic violence. And we also know there's high rates of that on college campuses. So 18 to 24 is really the high-risk time. Nationally, those averages are 1 in 4. And I say those statistics just to kind of put in place that it's not just a certain subset of people that experience domestic violence. It's not a certain background, a certain ethnicity, a certain socioeconomic. It just looks different across that spectrum.
Is it domestic violence if people are not in a committed relationship and not living under the same roof?
Well, in Kentucky, we just passed, actually, where you could get protective orders for intimate partner without having lived together, without having a child in common. We were the last state, really, to allow that to happen, because we knew. Well, I would work with young women on campuses, and they're like, I never lived with him. I didn't have a child in common, and you're telling me that I can't get protection from the court through a protective order. So I'm so glad that this year Kentucky actually passed IPOs, an individual protective order, where people can do that. So we look at it as, what is that relationship, and how does that relationship allow a person to have access to that individual? So dating couples to us would be domestic violence.
And then as our society has changed in terms of our definition of family and relationships, how has domestic violence evolved as a result of that? I mean, is it different when people have gone through the process of actually becoming married? Or is it more likely in a situation where people have made the commitment of marriage, or the other way around?
I don't know that it's more likely, but I think I hate to generalize, but I think a common scenario, and again, we were talking about that before the show started, is perpetrators of domestic violence are amazing manipulators, and they're amazing at kind of coming forward to present as this charming, wonderful, supportive person. And I think if you look at a typical relationship, when you start dating and you're involved with somebody, you become a sort of all consumed, you know, in that relationship. So you're with that person all the time. You kind of pull away a little bit from friends and family. And it's usually 3, 4, 5 months in, and sometimes longer, that all of a sudden when you start going back to those normal relationships, you know, I want to go spend some time with my friends, or I'm going to go visit my parents for the weekend, or I'm going to, you see all of a sudden that control start to seep in, and it kind of catches you a little blindsided, because it's like, how could this person who I'm so close to now be doing this? And I think people take a long time to try to figure it out. Is it something I did? Is it, and so it just varies. But I don't know that I would say there's more domestic violence in married couples. I just think the more involved you are with somebody, the more ability they have to control. So if you've got children, it's harder to pull away. If you've got housing together, it's harder to pull away.
Let me turn back to Lisa Murray. And Lisa, we have just 3 minutes before we take a station break, so I don't want to get too much into your story. You've told a very important elements of your story. You said it was September of 2011.
Yes.
And you were in a really bad way.
Yes.
How did you end up getting help? How did you end up getting services?
Well, I ended up in the hospital that night. And as the process went on, you know, trying to wade the system, getting a protective order, knowing at that moment, you know, I had to be out of this relationship. I had to get a divorce. There were lots of pieces of the puzzle that, you know, had to get rolling. So initially, it was all about the divorce. And then it was in January, the Commonwealth grand jury indicted him on a second degree felony assault. So that next part came into play. So I'm waiting a system of, I'm trying to get through a divorce. Then I'm waiting a system in a criminal courtroom that I know nothing about.
But so, but that night, for instance, you went to the hospital. Mm-hmm. What was did the hospital have specialized services? I mean, again, of course, obviously medical treatment immediately. I'm sure they assessed your situation. Were there folks involved right away who became involved in trying to serve as your advocate and help you get assistance?
No, I was actually very alone. And so that was another piece that we've been addressing with various hospitals. Because that night I should have been given an advocate. That night I should have gotten some direction, some help, some, you know, moral support, some emotional support, and yet I was alone.
So it was all very clinical. It was medical. Deal with the wounds, the physical, external wounds.
Yes, correct.
We are going to take a short break, but we are talking about domestic violence on this week's Eastern Standard. Lisa Murray here, a survivor of domestic violence. We're going to hear the story of Todd Schumacher, from his sister, Amy, who's here with us in the studio. And we have Diane Fleet, Assistant Director of Greenhouse 17. We're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories about domestic violence. And let us know what's on your mind. What do you want to know? Or are there some stories you'd like to share with us? Feel free to remain anonymous as you participate in our program by writing to us at WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST, or pick up the phone and call 800-621-8890.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me. It won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Domestic violence, our topic on this week's program. We're interested in hearing from you with your questions, your comments, your personal stories. We have a number of those questions emailed or sent to us one way or another, and we'll get to those in just a few minutes, but we want to hear the stories of our guests as well. But our email address, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Post on Facebook or the website. Especially after the program would be a good time to carry on the conversation there or be part of the show by calling 800-621-8890. With us, Diane Fleet of Greenhouse 17. Amy Schumacher, am I saying the name correctly? Schumacher.
Yes.
And her brother Todd, who was 40 years old, was stabbed and killed by his partner in a domestic violence situation almost 2 years ago now. And Lisa Murray, a survivor of domestic violence. And it's been about 5 years now since this all came to a head, and you began to get assistance. And we're going to come back to Lisa's story. You were in the hospital in September of 2011. Was there a prior history of violence with your husband? How long were you married?
There was. I was very silent about it. I didn't talk about it. My husband and I dated for 3 years. We married in January of 2007, and it was almost immediate. A lot of verbal abuse, emotional abuse was going on. But as the years went by 2010, it was starting to become physical. So there were several times he would shove me, pushed me, slapped me.
Was there alcohol or drugs involved?
There was alcohol involved, but honestly, I don't feel that... I don't feel you can put the blame on the alcohol or drugs.
No.
Or I think it's just part of that person.
You ended up in the hospital. The hospital provided clinical support, essentially, and really didn't provide any advocacy for you.
Correct.
How long were you in the hospital?
Correct. I was in the hospital for 2 days. When I was released from the hospital, it was a lot of bruising. And then damage to my eardrum was the main damage that I had to my right ear. I didn't have anyone here. I didn't feel like I could call my family. I was so afraid. I was embarrassed. And I reached out, was able to finally reach out to a colleague who came to my aid and helped me, and I actually stayed with her parents, didn't know these people.
A coworker.
Yes, a coworker, and stayed with her parents for a week. Her mother was a nurse, and she took care of me, and she set me up with appointments with various doctors for help with the different things that had happened. And so they were really, really good about that, but I didn't know at that time about Greenhouse 17. As the process went on and the frustrations were beginning to build, and then the criminal case was being built, I still was very, very lost. My brother was heavily involved with me. He would drive in from Ohio and be by my side in every court case. And then I had this wonderful attorney by the name of Luke Morgan, who just like appeared like an angel one day in the courtroom and said, "Just keep asking the questions, Lisa. You don't get the answers. Just keep asking the questions." And he was instrumental and by my side for a very long period of time. And as I asked the questions and I wasn't getting the answers I wanted, I started to get angry. And I started really just getting upset about what I felt was a lack of resource for women in the state of Kentucky. And I thought, I'm a bright woman. I know how to do internet research. Why are these links broken? Why can I not get answers from Frankfurt? Why, I felt like I was struggling all alone. Finally, one day, no one at my office except my direct supervisor knew anything about what was happening with me. But I finally reached out to a woman that I worked with who had ties in Frankfurt and had worked in Frankfurt. And I told her my story. And I just had a complete breakdown with her. And she said to me, "I know a woman named Carol Jordan. She's at University of Kentucky, and she handles the violence against women's studies there. You need to call her. I have her number." So through Carol Jordan, when I called her, told her my story, she immediately said, you were never told about bluegrass domestic violence advocacy? And I'm like, no, I don't even know what that is. Hmm. And in turn, bluegrass domestic violence advocacy now is Greenhouse 17, which covers 17 counties in the state of Kentucky. She put me in contact with Darlene Thomas, who was absolutely instrumental in everything in my life moving forward. And she helped my life to move forward. And so that was, you know, that was a big, big deal for me to finally find her, get that resource. And so that's one thing I like to be able to talk about Greenhouse 17 and all the services that they offer to women. Maybe you don't need shelter, but maybe you need emotional support. It's amazing at what we were able to accomplish together once I finally got that resource.
And what did that mean? Did that mean you went to meetings, that you went to counseling sessions, that you had in one-on-one advice from folks who kind of helped guide you along the path?
Exactly. It was a lot of one-on-one. Darlene became my direct advocate. There are more advocates in the agency than just Darlene, but Darlene became my one-on-one advocate. She helped me and my brother to wade the courtroom process, and she helped us to understand better the legal system and what was going to happen and what was going to transpire. She helped, there were several times that, we were just completely lost. Like, we didn't understand what certain things meant in the courtroom or in the court system. And she helped us to answer all of those questions. She was by my side every time I walked into that courtroom. And to have someone to be able to hold their hand, you're looking at the person that you married, that you loved, and you're trying to put these feelings into perspective, and you're in the middle of a court battle, and you're watching someone that initially you started out in a happy relationship where you thought you're going to build a life together, and then the next thing you're sitting across a courtroom from that person. So they were instrumental in helping me. They also helped me financially, because during that time, I was so fearful that he was going to retaliate. I moved three times, and moving three times in 1 year is a huge financial undertaking.
And it's very high on this list of things that create stress in a person's life as well.
Yes, yes. And that same year, I had wrecked my car. Never been in an accident in my life, and then my car's totaled. So I moved three times, had my car totaled. I'm facing court battles and everything. And Greenhouse 17 helped me financially there for 3 months, helping me with my rent the first 3 months. And, it took a huge burden off of me to be able to sit back for a minute and take a breath and be able to continue to move forward and, to understand the process a little bit better.
Where, shortcutting too quickly, but where do things stand right now? Was your husband convicted of a crime? I assume the divorce has been dealt with, and things are stable?
Yes. 5 years later, I can say that I'm on the other side of that fence now. I have a lot of joy, happiness, great things happening in my life. We were divorced. It was a long process, but finally, after a year, I was granted a divorce. He did go to prison. He went to prison for 1 year in the state of Kentucky. Because he was a Dutch national and was not a U.S. citizen, we had lots of other parts and pieces to my case, and he was taken into custody by the federal government. He was in federal prison for about 5 months. Unfortunately, the last piece of the case that we had hoped we would achieve, which would have been his deportation, did not happen. The federal judge ruled that the state of Kentucky did not fully prove on the domestic violence, and it's the way our legislation is worded. There's lots of things going on in Frankfort. Greenhouse 17 had taken all of that under advisement, and so there's a lot of people that are working on that and looking at our laws and looking at our statutes and how things, this was a unique case. Hmm. And so it's being addressed, but he is now living freely in the United States, and You know, he lives out of the state now, which I'm thankful for, so he's not close. But it's still, you know, every day it's still a fear in me.
Sure.
It will be with me, I think, forever. So, and I suffer from PTSD from that. And, you know, but I can say I feel like I have reached the other side.
Wow. Lisa Murray is with us on this week's Eastern Standard, and we are really grateful for your openness and willingness to tell your story such an excellent job of telling the story. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're talking domestic violence on this week's show, WEKU Eastern Standard. Let's see. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. I'm getting all my addresses confused here. That's the email address, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. If you'd like to ask a question or tell a personal story, give us a call at 800-621-8890. Let me turn back to Diane Fleet, Assistant Director of Greenhouse 17. Lisa's story sounds so extreme. Is it less extreme than we think it is? I mean, is it more common than we would tend to think it is?
I think it's far more common than what we would like to think that it is. And again, I think it's one of those things, you know, it really resonates that, you know, Lisa has to look at her at the face, you know, it has a lot of resources to her. And so there's a tendency, I think, for folks who reach out to Greenhouse 17. Again, it's why I really not like for folks to think of us just as shelter. But there's a lot of people that you would think would have easy access and easy connection to services. And quite honestly, her experience with the hospital was terrible. Her confusion in the court system, it doesn't matter if you have a college degree and if you make $200,000 a year or $20,000, I mean, it's a confusing system. It's a complicated system on top of the anxiety and trauma that you're facing. So no, I don't think that it's an extreme case. I think the international component was a little bit different from most people. And I think our goal really is to look at each case uniquely and sort of figure out what it is that they need to go from, I think our phrase is, from crisis to self-sufficiency. So if that needs court advocacy, if that needs financial connection, if that means counseling and advocacy, if that means shelter, we just try to put it together because everybody's experience is a little unique.
If you had a time machine and could roll back to that night in September with Lisa in her situation, what would you like to have seen happen in that situation? She got away from the immediate cause, the immediate threat of violence, and ended up in the hospital getting help. What should have been happening on your checklist of the ideal?
Sure. Well, one of the things, this isn't exactly what you're asking, but I like that some of our focus now is moving to prevention so that people, whether they're at workplace, friends, family, can begin to recognize those signs that might indicate something's going on in a situation so that it can be intervention before we even get to the hospital. But Greenhouse 17 has great partners, but I think, you know, when we're talking about a 25 staff and 17 county region and everybody sort of doing, prosecutors and police and hospitals all sort of operating their own different way, a team should have wrapped around her. She should have gone to the hospital. It should have been identified as domestic violence. And at that moment, a connection to the advocacy programs of Greenhouse 17, along with advocates and prosecutor's office, there's many of them, so that a safety plan could be wrapped around her that included, where are you going to live? What's your emotional needs right now? What are your financial needs? And what do you need to navigate this court system?
There should have been advocates, people arriving in the hospital that very evening?
There absolutely should have been, or a quick connection. Sexual assault programs are actually pretty good at that. Domestic violence programs have really put a lot of their effort into support groups in the community and court system. But that doesn't mean that those systems couldn't have been in place. She shouldn't have waited months and months before that connection should have occurred.
Let me turn to Amy Schumacher now. And Amy, your brother's death in January of 2015 was highly publicized, was in the news, and there has been a trial. Tell us the story of your brother. And he was gay.
Yes.
And had a partner, and a partner that he was with for some time?
It was an on and off relationship for 2 years, but prior they had been together within that year leading up to his death. And one night I was wondering why I wasn't getting a hold of my brother. I tried to communicate with him a few different times. I didn't hear anything.
You moved down. He encouraged you to come down. You were in business together, working together.
Well, we did separate work, but we would often confide in work together. He did electrical. I do landscape and handiwork. So we had a lot of mutual friends. Our social groups definitely intertwine, and that was nice since we're not from around this area at all. I went to check on him in January, and I saw something through a window that I did not like. I saw blood everywhere, and I got in the house, and I found my brother murdered, and the person that murdered him was right next to him in the house, and the police were dispatched from there. I didn't know what was going on, but I know that I had contact with my brother about 5 days prior to this event. We were, he called in panic because his dog, his beloved dog, was missing, and, you know, did whatever we could. We looked everywhere in town to try to find his dog because he loved his dog so much. But I don't know, after I find out some details, you kind of put pieces together. Unfortunately, those pieces coming together are too late. The morning after I found my brother passed away, animal control pulled up to his residence because I went back to his house and just making sure everything was cool there. Animal control came and said, and I was wondering why they were there, and they go, well, I know Monroe is missing, the dog. I need to get in the house. I need to look around the house. I'm scared that he might be in the oven because this incident took place back in September. I guess that's when the guy that killed my brother put his dog in an oven and tried and burned the dog. And my brother had told his partner at the time that you need to turn yourself in. You did something horrible. You tried to hurt my dog. And there was an animal care citation out against him on that event since it's animal cruelty. And from there, so I find out of that the next morning. And then I find out things after. It's always after. I found out about something when my brother and that same guy went to visit my family farm. Something happened that was strange. The dog was missing.
We're going to go ahead and take a break here, but we're going to come back.
Okay.
There's a pattern, clearly.
A pattern, definitely. That's what I want to get ahead.
Very unusual behavior going on there. Amy Schumacher is with us. Her brother Todd was stabbed and killed by a partner in a domestic violence situation in January of 2015. Lisa Murray is here with us, Diane Fleet. We're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories as we discuss domestic violence on Eastern Standard. Write to us, WEKU Eastern Standard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKU EST. We would be glad to get you on the phone and hear your voice as part of the show if you'd like to be part of the conversation. 800-621-8890.
Bruises fade, Father, but the pain.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Domestic violence is the focus of our conversation this morning. We would like to get our listeners involved. Some very compelling stories, obviously, from our guests and the resources of Greenhouse 17 in our conversation today, as well as folks who have been touched by domestic violence, either personally or very close in their families. 800-621-8890. Feel free to get on board and be part of our conversation with your story or your question, 800-621-8890. And we're turning back to Amy Schumacher. Sorry we had to interrupt for a station break, but your brother Todd was 40 years old in a relationship of sorts, a partnership, I guess, was it, were they in a committed partnership?
It was a relationship. I mean, in terms, you'd probably be saying you're still dating yet.
Okay.
So.
But living together?
But living together, yes.
And the guy that he was living with, there was a pattern of some pretty weird and very hateful stuff going on related to the dog.
Yes. Obviously some form of animal abuse, and we realized when we kept, you know, talking to people and even my folks, we've seen an escalation of events relating with his dog. And unfortunately, you don't see that until after something bad has happened.
Todd didn't bring that up?
He didn't bring it up. And I don't know if he was, you know, scared that I might say something or I don't know. But I also noticed that he never, after that event when the dog was burned in the oven, that he never showed me, he never had me see Monroe again either. So it was weird. When you look back at it, it's like he didn't want me to know something. And that's, it's very unfortunate because maybe you could have did something. If you had just a piece to go by, maybe we could have helped Todd, could have helped the dog. You know, it all goes together.
What do you know about the circumstances of your brother's death? I mean, you were the, and that's difficult for me to think about. You were the person who discovered your brother. And I mean, what do you think occurred when your brother died? That there was a fight?
Well, the partner said there was a fight and that he was defending himself. My brother, I don't believe there, I believe my brother got blindsided, but that is my opinion. But I was there. I saw the house. Unfortunately, I know a lot of internal details with that part, but I do know there was that there was talk of my brother was threatened by a hammer. His partner wanted to kill him with a hammer at one point. It was documented. There's just other things that come up.
Now, your brother was a contractor, electrical contractor. Mm-hmm. I didn't know your brother, but I'm assuming that by all appearances, he was probably not a frail person who seemed
to be threatened. And this is the stereotype with this as well.
Yeah.
My brother was a strong guy. Mm-hmm. And when he passed away, him and the partner were about the same size. Now my brother is stronger. He's just always been a strong guy. We've always done manual labor. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. If you surprise somebody, someone's going to lose. The person that gets surprised is most likely going to lose in this situation. And if someone is taking over the relationship in an abusive way, you play in mind games, you're strategizing basically, right? And that's the only way this could have happened.
I mean, the party that is abused, the victim, for lack of a better term, is it a correct term? Are we using the word victim? Because I know some people like to talk about not wanting to be victims.
Right, and we often talk about survivors pieces, but I think in this case we would certainly talk about victim. And I think usually it's the victim that kind of determines at what point are we dealing with the crisis and what point have I moved beyond. So like Lisa might say, I'm a survivor now. I've come out on the other side.
I guess what I'm thinking of is that the survivor, the victim, doesn't want to be in that role. And they want to be proud and strong and put on a strong face.
Right.
And the people they work with, Todd was working with people doing work for them in the community. His clients, his customers, he wouldn't want to come across as being someone who was in that situation.
Right. I mean, not even to me. And we were fairly close. And that's what's hard.
And that's something... Without cutting off your story, that's something we're learning here about domestic violence, that there's a component that we don't see, that if we could just kind of look in the circumstances and identify, you know, things that we see happening in the grocery store or out in public, perhaps there'd be better help for people in the community. I mean, if I may ask Diane Fleet of Greenhouse 17, when males are the victim or the survivor of domestic violence, I mean, how does the dynamic change, and what do we need culturally to help break down the circumstances that create tragic outcomes such as that of Todd Schumacher?
Well, I think, you know, as in the beginning when we were talking about the definition, is really, again, not looking just at physical violence always, but just knowing that that's a component of it, but really looking at the power and control dynamics. That really is the motivation behind the perpetrator. And you specialize that. So in this case, when we're talking about Todd, his love of his dog was a way that this perpetrator could utilize and control and frighten and manipulate and take control over that relationship. That's not unusual. And so when you work with a person and you do kind of a safety plan around them, what is it that's important to them? Is it their job? Is it their career? Is it their status in the community? Is it their physical safety? Is it, what is it? Because that's what a perpetrator will hone in on. And I think the other piece that we really need to shift is looking at batterer behavior. So switching that, not why does he or she stay, but why does he or she abuse, and really continue again to focus on the abusive partner, because a victim is just trying to manage as best they can. And sometimes that looks like they're colluding, because for safety, it's safer for them to stay in the relationship to leave. That's the most dangerous time, when you leave. So sometimes it doesn't look logical from the outside, but that person is doing everything they can to stay safe.
Let me come back to Amy Schumacher. So the resolution of your brother's situation, I mean, obviously his partner was accused and convicted of murder, manslaughter?
Originally went in the courtroom hoping to get murder. We ended up with manslaughter too, unfortunately, which is really a slap for the crime that was committed. This crime was so brutal. Over 80 stab wounds does not justify manslaughter too. And I'm already looking at the parole board in a couple months here, at the end of the year.
Not even 2 years since the crime.
Right. 20% of time is when they're up for parole again. So we're almost 2 years into this process, so that's 20%.
What is the dynamic of it being a same-sex relationship? I mean, had this, and maybe, again, Diane can help us with that, if this were not a same-sex relationship, would the outcome criminally have been different? And what is your perception, Amy?
My perception is that I think the outcome would have been different. Unfortunately, I would like to believe it. Everybody's going to come to the table with, for justice, mm-hmm. In itself. But unfortunately, I think that played a big part of it. I think that was a focus. And I don't want to think that way, but I'm pretty sure that was definitely looked at.
And are there elements in Kentucky law that are needing to be addressed that would create a different environment going forward?
Just to look at equality in general. I mean, we have to look at everybody on the same playing field. It does not matter where you come from, what's your sexual preference, anything. It does not matter. We all need to be created equal.
I think a big piece is certainly, how much can you educate a jury? So depending jury to jury. I think another piece is what evidence can you bring forward in the criminal case? So some of those pieces I think could be, and I'm not as familiar, I didn't sit in on this trial, but I do think there was a lot of information that was not shared that I think led directly into the abusive environment that was in the home that the jury didn't even have access to.
You're right.
So I think... Definitely. I think there's prejudice. I think there could be stereotypes. Who is a victim of domestic violence? Did the person fight back? You know, we're seeing a lot more victims sort of fighting back. And so we're running into that issue of victims of domestic violence being incarcerated because they're to the point of, I'm not taking this anymore. So I think there's lots of different pieces. But education of jury, but certainly what evidence can a court bring in so you get a full comprehensive picture?
We have a few minutes remaining if you'd like to get on board by calling 800-621-8890, our show live on Thursday morning, the show repeating on Sunday evening, and a podcast available as well. But if you're calling on Thursday morning at 11:51, there is time to get on the air at 800-621-8890. Here's a message that came in actually before the show from a listener in Berea who writes, 2 years ago, a young woman I knew was killed by her boyfriend who in a rage beat her over the head with a hammer. This girl had been sexually abused by her father when she was small and in her late teens, began dating and living with a series of men who abused her. I was a friend and mentor to her during her early teenage years, then lost touch as time and distance parted us. She was once so full of life and joy and was a talented singer and compassionate friend. Why are women drawn to such men? What effect does child abuse play in domestic violence? Is there something I could have said or done in her years before this started that would have helped? A note from a listener, anonymous in Berea. Diane.
Well, you know, there is certainly a higher propensity. If you're an adult survivor of child sexual abuse or domestic violence, there is a higher rate of future domestic violence or sexual assault in the lifetime. I wouldn't say necessarily, though, that a person is drawn to that. I think there's lots of different things that can be going on. So sometimes we have compassion and empathy, and we sort of see our own childhood, and we have a tendency to sometimes think that we can overlook and help the partner that we're with. We sometimes normalize or minimize those experiences because it's what we've grown up with. So, you know, a person who hasn't had that experience, it might kind of red flag them a little bit quicker. It might depend on resources. It might depend on their emotional state. So, you know, I just think there's so many things that kind of go into that place. But I would never say somebody's drawn to an abusive relationship ever. And again, I would go back to what is the manipulation that the perpetrator can play over another person. That's where the focus needs to be.
We talk about that issue of being drawn to such relationships. Is that just another way of blaming the victim?
I think so, but I think with the best of intentions. I'm not going to say in my, you know, 50 years of life, I've not said things like that, you know, because that's who you're working with. But when you get at the essence, when you spend time, when you work with families and friends and survivors, and you get at it, you really do find that that's not what's going on in those cases at all.
Robert from Lexington had called in early in the program and had just passed on a message. Why is there such little attention to the treatment of offenders and they should be treated? Is there a lack of due process to allow the defender to defend him or herself against allegations? And then he talks about power and control issues by one to exert over others, but wonders if they occur because of poor communication systems and the ability to manage anger. Number of issues in there, but what about treatment of offenders? I mean, we think in terms of commission of crimes, and in both situations, the examples we're talking about here today, violent, horrible crimes committed, one ending in death. Is our society, should our society be focused on treatment or punishment and holding up the potential for punishment as a deterrent?
Well, I think you need both, or many things. So I think you need swift reaction by court, law enforcement, which is much better than what it used to be, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But you need consistent accountability by the court system. You need a community that says zero tolerance when it comes to domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking and bullying, which you were talking the other day you had on your case. But I think you should always have the ability for offender treatment. And there are offender treatment programs out there. We really try not to use anger management. Anger management to us means at any point, you might explode in anger. Domestic violence is much more methodical on who that anger is addressed to and who that control is. So you're not a person who's just spouting off at work or spouting off. You are very intentional behind closed doors with that intimate partner. So we look at offender treatment. But you have to have the ability. It's kind of like going to AA meetings. If you're not at a place to admit you have a problem, then offender treatment's not going to be very successful. And offenders are really good at blaming everybody else around them.
There have been some changes in Kentucky law in recent years. To assist, at least to help with resolving domestic violence situations?
Well, we finally passed, we're really excited, the dating violence law. So before, to get a protective order, you had to have a child in common, live together, or been married together. So now, actually, dating partners don't have to have a child in common, don't have to have lived together. So an intimate partner, IPO, can now be filed, which is critical because really the highest rates of domestic violence and sexual assault occur in that 18 to 24-year-old range. And we're seeing an aging group of people that maybe are widowed or divorced, and they don't live together with their partner as much. So our aging group didn't have access to protective orders, and our younger kind of college age or out of high school age didn't have access to protective orders. So that's probably the biggest thing.
So going forward, and I guess I should turn to Lisa and to Amy, give you each a minute or so to talk about what do you advise others who may be in a situation you were in or may find themselves and don't even know it yet, but may eventually find themselves in? What should they be thinking in terms of getting help to resolve such situations?
I think here in the state of Kentucky, it's getting the word out about Greenhouse 17 and knowing that there is a telephone number that they can call. Maybe they're not ready to go into shelter. Maybe they're not even sure they're in a domestic violence situation. Maybe they think, ma'am, you know, maybe it's not that bad, you know. But maybe they'd like someone who actually, you know, is a professional that deals with this every day.
But knowing awareness of the fact that there are services, that there's help available.
Yes.
And let me turn again to Amy Schumacher. Your advice, your comments for directing it towards same-sex couples and to men who may be experiencing domestic violence.
Obviously, there's many forms, and any form of domestic violence is not okay, and for anybody. So it's, you know, get help, talk to your friends, do something. If you don't take any action, you're not going to be able to get any help. So you have to get the word out somehow. Yes, you do have to worry about your personal well-being, but you have to say something, because if you don't, it will be too late, unfortunately, as in this case. Your friends aren't always going to see the signs, so you have to give them a blatant sign.
Diane Fleet, we're going to make sure we put resources on our website at weku.fm, the website, I guess, greenhouse17.org.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Amy Schumacher.
Thank you so, so much for your openness and willingness to tell Todd's story.
Thank you.
And likewise, Lisa Murray, thank you so much for your openness.
Thank you.
Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. Our associate producers are Marissa Hempel, Brian Burkhart, and Grant Willoughby. Our technical director, Brian Bartlett. A reminder, this show will be available online as a podcast later today and will repeat on the air Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. We're always interested in your comments, questions, or personal stories. WEKU Eastern Standard @gmail.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at WEKU EST. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm John Hingsburg, and thanks for tuning in.